campus of Texas A&M University. The Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. We are so glad that you took the time to download us and that you're spending time with us today. We are also very happy to have another leader in the field of sports medicine, exercise science with us today. We have Dr. John Buchanan with us, who is a professor of motor neuroscience here at Texas A&M. Dr. Buchanan has a PhD in complex systems and brain systems from Florida Atlantic University. It turned out that he and I were at Florida Atlantic University at about the same time. And in different roles. But yeah, so this science is a small world, isn't it, John?
Yes, it is. Very small.
We're so happy to have you here.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Tell us what motor neuroscience is.
Well, motor neuroscience is understanding how the brain processes perceptual information, and then we use that information to help us move our bodies through the world, thereby gathering more information.
How do you measure that? How do you measure how the brain perceives the world?
Well, there's a lot of ways in which it can be measured. It can be measured either at the neurological level through scanning techniques, or it can be measured behaviorally, which is what I do. In other words, you manipulate some type of sensory display, usually visual, could be auditory, and then you look at how performance changes as a function of that manipulation.
So you have them, like, watch a video screen or something?
Sometimes they'll watch a computer monitor that has a certain amount of information on it that's somehow related to what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then you change that presentation and then see if it changes behavior or changes their coordination. And then the idea is, if you don't have a brain measure, you try to link it to what people know about given areas based on how that's similar to your task and your behavior.
Okay. We'll ask you a big question. Does it work?
Well, I think it works. I get papers published sometimes.
So the scientific literature thinks it works as well, right?
That's right. They think it works.
Yeah. And I know you've been applying some of these things recently in disease populations, like stroke populations.
I'm hopefully going to start that within about a month.
Okay.
I have looked at other patient populations in my past, vestibular loss subjects. So those are people who have problems with balance because your vestibular system is part of your inner ear.
Right.
And it tells you how your head moves in space, how your trunk moves, how you're oriented to gravity, so on.
So people like with vertigo and things like that?
No, these people are beyond vertigo.
Oh, are they?
They're usually people who've had extensive damage such that the system is not functioning. So they really don't have, like, head orientation information. They don't have, like, orientation to gravity and stuff like this.
So does it work with those patients?
The study, sure.
Yeah.
It does. Because basically you can demonstrate and compare them to normal controls, and you look at the difference, and you can clearly show that under this condition, their behavioral response is this way because they don't have that information from orientation to gravity.
Right.
Or it's this other way because they don't have head angular acceleration and so on.
Yeah, so how do you do this training? And, I mean, walk us through one of these experiments that you do.
Well, it all depends. The ones I did involved a moving platform.
Okay.
So you put people on the platform, and then the platform can move back and forth anterior, posteriorly.
Do they control this as a balance thing, or is it...
You control it.
Okay.
As the experimenter... Well, actually, the device could work either way.
Yeah.
So you could set it up to be free.
Right.
And there are some people who use those kind of devices, but we used it to actually control the motion of the floor and see how they respond to it.
Oh, so you move the floor around.
We move the floor on them.
And then you're seeing how they respond to images on the screen? Or?
In that case, it wouldn't be images. That case, it's just the movement of the floor.
Yeah.
But the idea is that they're getting visual input based on how their head moves. And then you can show that under certain conditions, they can use that visual input to help them, and that under other conditions, the visual input doesn't do them much good.
Do people get adjusted to that movement? I know when I'm on a ship for, you know, a couple days at a time, I don't observe the movement of the ship anymore. It's like I compensate, and it's kind of there. And then when I get off the ship is when I realize that I'm still swaying
like I think
the ship should be.
You have sea legs.
So is that kind of, if someone were on your moving platform, I guess long enough, do they get adjusted to that?
They can adjust to the platform. They can adapt. Vestibular patients never adapt completely to the loss of the input, though.
Yeah.
It's just because it's no longer there.
Fabulous. Well, so they show gains.
They show gains.
They show gains. Does this help with learning or?
The stuff we looked at so much didn't involve learning. It was really more just kind of adaptive responses based on kind of the range of sensory inputs you think a certain system operates, like where vision operates, where the vestibular system operates. The stuff I want to look at hopefully with stroke patients, we'll look more at learning and using, again, perceptual displays to see if we can facilitate motor learning.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get interested in this? I mean, one of the things we talk about in the podcast quite a bit is what brings people to what they're doing. And so the journey is actually quite interesting often. So what journey did you take to get to where you're at now? I mean, this is not something you woke up in the morning one day and said, you know, by golly, I'm going to start looking at this stuff.
I almost felt like it sometimes. I was interested in psychology, primarily cognitive experimental psychology. And so I went to get a master's degree at FAU. I met Scott Kelso there. Mm. And through our interaction, I thought that pursuing this understanding of movement was really kind of a way to get at both sort of cognitive features as well as more sort of basic perceptual processes. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I could kind of combine different things together. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I decided to pursue that.
Mm. Yeah, and for those listeners out there, Scott Kelso is a name that's quite famous in the motor science world and in complex systems world.
That's right.
Yeah. So John studied with the best. So how has that progressed from there? Because you obviously didn't get out of school yesterday.
No. From there, I went to Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
Spent
yeah.
3 years out there. I went there because I wanted to get exposure to a totally different point of view in terms of how people look at the motor system. So,
how was their view different?
Well, Kelso's view is from what is called a self-organizing point of view.
Okay.
And that's kind of the notion that you understand interaction across levels.
Okay.
And you don't try to think about a lot of, can I identify something that's controlling everything?
Okay.
It's the idea that the control comes through the interaction.
Okay.
When I went out to Portland, it's really more the idea is there are controlling areas.
Mm.
And if you look at how sensory information is distorted, then you can see how the control kind of changes. And so my goal there was just to get a different viewpoint and get exposed to working with patient populations.
Yeah. So which viewpoint do you buy into now?
I kind of buy into both. I mean, personally, I think that neither viewpoint can explain the entire picture. I think that the self-organizing point of view is really good at explaining our kind of ongoing interactions with things in the world. Okay, you know, so how we walk down the hallway, how we open a door, how we move through the door, how we take in perceptual information right then and then turn around and use it.
Right.
The other approach is maybe much better when we deal with problems of like memory. And we think about how we may want to process perceptual information to form long-term memories of actions and stuff. And I think that our movement is really kind of an interaction of that. So if you're really skilled, you can do the same thing over and over again very good, but you can also adapt very quickly to changing conditions.
Yeah, and people don't think, they don't think about movement much because they do it naturally.
Right.
But it's a pretty complex pattern that's required to make, just be able to walk down the hall.
Well, I think a lot of that we learn when we're young.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So, you know, walking, balancing, and most people think, well, you know how to write your name, you do this. It's like, well, how hard can it be? And I think we've all forgotten
how hard it really
is. How hard it really was, because we don't remember it when we're little kids and stuff like that. But when you study people who do this kind of stuff for a living, like, you know, musicians in terms of their hands or athletes in terms of their performance, you can see that they're continuously learning how to adjust what they know to changing conditions.
Now, I know you're a musician, so you just mentioned musician.
I try.
Okay. Do you ever apply any of this stuff to yourself to test yourself to see how you're learning these patterns?
No. I think about it, but I don't try to test it.
No.
I mean, I guess you do try to test it, but I don't do it scientifically.
No. Well, yeah, you're probably doing it the most efficacious way you can think of, right?
Right.
Yeah. You say, I think this will really work, so I'm going to give this a shot.
I'm going to try it, right.
Yeah. So what do you try? What really works?
Well, I think what really works is...
what are you applying to yourself?
Variability in practice is something that works a lot. Learning how to use sensory input. Like in music, the hard thing to do is to identify what the tone is. So you can match the tone or so you can match the rhythm.
Right.
And again, in any type of skill, repetition is important.
Right.
So I clearly understand that I have to do the same thing over and over again.
Right.
But by doing that, then I also get better at being flexible.
Okay,
because the idea is you don't always do it the exact same thing over, but you do different things over and over again.
That's the variability in practice.
That's the variability in practice idea.
So you, kind of do the same thing, but you do it with a different flair.
That's right. And there are people out there who think you only can do one, or you only have to be variable, or you always have to be specific.
Mm.
Personally, I think it's a combination.
And that works. That works for you.
That works for me.
So we have a case study of one.
Case study of one. And
it all works.
I had a member on my dissertation committee said, if you run one subject, you get the results you need, you don't need any more. He was a physicist by training.
I guess
theoretical one at that. So I said, oh, that'd be nice.
So I guess a theoretical physicist, all they're looking for is one thing to prove that
That's
their
right.
theories are correct. Right?
If it meets his mathematical solutions, then it's like, it's got to be right on.
Yeah. Now, our listeners should know that I guess in the biological sciences, we need more cases than that.
Right.
You usually test. How many subjects you normally test in a normal study?
My experiments run 6 to 10 because we collect a lot of data over and over, a lot of repetitions.
Mm-hmm.
But they can run up to 40, some people, depending on the study.
How does your work benefit the general public?
That's a tough question. That's what I'm going to find out, hopefully, when I start the work with the stroke patients.
Yeah. How would you guess? Well, as scientists, we don't like to guess.
Right.
But let's guess. You have some idea.
I mean, if I guess, it should benefit people in terms of developing practice context.
Mm.
Recently, we've done some work on observational learning and, shown that observational learning has slightly different benefits than physical practice.
Mm.
And so one idea would be if you want to develop training protocols is to come up with a way to try to combine the two.
Mm.
I know there's some current research out there that's looking at this sort of idea.
What's observational learning?
That's where you learn by watching and not doing.
Okay.
And again, the idea can be, how much can you learn just by watching?
Okay.
How does that interact with both watching and then getting to do some versus just doing is sort of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been the notion that, especially if you go back to like what I want to try with stroke patients, is one idea might be that observation is a way to overcome fatigue, which they experience. So if you can show that they can understand perceptually what's going on and maybe gain some motor benefits from kind of an observational point of view, then you could say that maybe this can then supplement some of the physical stuff that they have to do.
So it's almost like reprogramming their brain just by visualization.
It's trying to use vision to help them.
So there's been a lot of public discussion recently and some scientific discussion about what's more important for success in, we'll say, athletic endeavors, practice, the genes that you were born with, persistence. We've had people on the podcast that would argue that persistence is very important, maybe not the most important thing, but very important to success, actually in many different fields of endeavor. There are authors out there that would suggest that practice is the only thing, that that magical 10,000 hours of practice that some people advocate. So the stuff that you're doing falls into the area of practice. What do you think about that whole discussion?
I think practice is important, no doubt. I think there's enough evidence to indicate that genetics can play a role.
Okay.
Kind of like a jumping off point. But again, like a lot of people say, if you want to reach your potential, then you have to practice. Without the practice, you don't reach your potential. And I also think that...
But does everybody have the same potential?
That's a good question.
Okay.
I would say maybe not physically.
Okay.
But that's because they may have potential elsewhere. I mean, clearly people are uncoordinated, whatever that may mean.
Right.
I'm coordinated in some things I do, but not all.
Well, people have less motor skills than others.
Sure. But that doesn't mean they don't have a lot of intellectual capacity.
Right. Exactly.
But the idea is that genetics probably plays a component in all of these things.
Right.
But then what also can play a component is the development of it.
Right.
I don't think you can argue purely nature nurture.
Right.
Because it's a dynamical system. It interacts.
Right.
This is what happens in the world.
Yeah. I think for argument's sake, people love to argue either or, but
sure.
In reality, it's always an and situation.
That's right.
It's usually both things.
That's
or
right.
At least all three things.
That's what I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the practice stuff is very important.
I think practice is very important.
Yeah. And figuring out how to best do it.
And the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I think some of the research I've done has looked at that, and I think same way with some of the other people here.
Yeah.
focus a lot on the idea of practice. Hmm.
So what's your take-home message for people listening out there, and they you know have just been awed by Dr. John Buchanan,
all me and my discussions.
Yeah. What would your take-home message be?
Keep practicing.
Our society, our culture has gotten to where people think that they can go on a reality TV show and suddenly become stars without the practice. I mean, we see that every year on some of these shows. And so those shows actually would argue would argue for practice. That if you don't put in a certain amount of practice or have a certain amount of talent,
you're not any good.
Reality show or not.
Reality. I don't watch much reality TV.
Yeah.
Because I live in the real world. I don't think those people live in the real world, but that's a kind of a different kind of an issue.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think if you want to be good at anything, you got to practice. You got to find somebody that can help you.
Right.
I think that's a key thing, is looking for people who can give you the appropriate type of information and how to use it. And I think that includes all things of what we've kind of talked about. Training.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't talked about nutrition, but that would be a component of the Huffines type institute, mm-hmm. and then the idea of exercise.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I always try to talk to people about is that exercise is different from doing the thing.
Mm.
And that both I think are important.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have like an exercise routine, and then you need to have practice for what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be somehow separate from each other.
Right.
Combined, but yet separate.
That almost sounds like a good take-home message.
Okay, that's my take-home message. Am I going to say it again?
Yeah, sure.
I can never see. That's what's the whole idea behind a self-organizing system is you can never do it the same way twice because the conditions have changed.
Well, the variation, though, will help people remember
it. That's right. Enough variation to keep it stable.
That's right.
Again, it's the idea that exercise is a benefit for one thing.
Right.
Practicing your skill is a benefit for another thing.
Mm.
And that I think to be the best at what you want to do, you should come up with ways to do those things independently, but then also come up with ways to combine it.
Great take-home message, Sean.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
And thank you for being here with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Been enjoyable. Yeah. We'll have to have you back to find out how the stroke patients are doing.
Give me 3 or 4 months.
3 or 4 months. Okay. It's a date.
All right.
In the meantime, while we're waiting to hear what the results of your outcome are, I think we have a podcast question of the week from one of our new producers, Cheryl Merrick. So, Cheryl?
What is observational learning?
Good question. And so, be the first one to respond to us with the right answer via email, and you'll win one of those nifty Huffines podcast t-shirts. And once again, thanks, John.
Thank you.
We enjoyed it.
Enjoyed it, Tim.
Thank you all for taking time to download us and spending time with us. And we hope that you join us next week for another leader in the field of sports medicine. And if you haven't already, check out our video podcast. We had some of the best people in the country doing 15-minute video podcasts at understandable levels about some of the newest things happening in sports medicine. It's pretty cool stuff. So check it out. Until then, we hope that you have an active and healthy week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.